This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Taras Gresko, author of The Devil's Picnic, The End of Elsewhere, and Sacre Blues, which was shortlisted for the Writers' Trust Award and was a national bestseller in Canada. His work appears in major publications in the United States, the UK, and Canada, including The Independent, Gourmet, The Guardian, National Geographic Traveler, and The New York Times. Taras Gresko is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood, published in 2008 by Bloomsbury Press. Welcome.
Good morning, Diane. How are you doing?
What led you to write your book, Bottom Feeder?
Oh, gosh. About 14 years ago, I decided to get most of the protein in my diet from fish and seafood. I lived in Europe for a little while, and I came back to the West Coast, and I wanted to eat healthily and also sort of avoid some of the worst excesses of the industrial food chain. So fish at the time seemed to be incredibly abundant. But gradually, I started to realize that there were problems with the seafood. The oceans weren't bottomless. For example, there was a cod collapse off Newfoundland in the 90s. One of the biggest stocks of fish in the world disappeared all of a sudden. And other things happened. Of course, people started becoming more conscious of what was going on with certain species like swordfish and Chilean sea bass. There was the whole tuna issue. So I wanted to educate myself about my diet. I wanted to design a trip around the world that would allow me to become educated about fish eating. I wanted to become a smart, ethical piscivore or seafood eater.
What's the significance of Bottom Feeder in the title of your book?
Bottom Feeder is, I'm not referring to the fact that I only eat nasty, slimy things at the bottom of the sea. It's actually more the idea that right now we're eating at the top level of the food chain, of the oceanic food chain. We prefer fish like tuna, swordfish, salmon, that kind of thing. And these things are predatory species that eat quite high up the food chain. So the idea of Bottom Feeder is actually more eating towards the middle and lower levels of the food chain. You know, more like things like mackerel, herring, the little fish that are actually quite abundant, sardines, anchoveda, that kind of thing, which are now ground up to make feed for shrimp farming and salmon farming. And it turns out that at the lower end of the food chain, there's actually a lot of amazing flavors. Local cuisines around the world, whether it's in the south of France with rockfish from the Mediterranean, or Asian cuisines, for example, they really like things that we tend to avoid, not the prestige protein at the center of the plate, but often they have traditions of eating things like cuttlefish or squid or jellyfish, that kind of thing. So I wanted to explore some of those traditions as I traveled around the world too. And also, I mean, see some of the worst excesses of what's going on, the tuna auctions in Tsukiji Market, where they're now in Tokyo, where they're now eating the last of the giant bluefin tuna. And I wanted to meet some fishermen and talk to them about what they're doing, sardine fishermen in Portugal, for example.
You've been alluding to this, but would you give a brief overview of the state of the world's fisheries?
Well, my decision to start eating fish coincided with the peak of the world's wild fishery catch in about, this was about 1987. And since then, the catch has been going down by about 500,000 tons per year. So we've taken up some of the slack. The seafood stores and restaurants still have lots of seafood in them because farming has taken up the slack. About 45% of the seafood we eat now is farmed. So we have to find ways to farm sustainably, and unfortunately, the wild catch still goes on, and we're catching species like sardines and anchoveda and using them to make feed for the farmed fish. So there's a simple way to rejig your eating habits. One of them is to avoid these big predatory species, like carnivorous species, like salmon, for example. Alternatives are carp, tilapia. Even some species like Arctic char and trout are slightly better choices than farmed salmon because they tend to be raised inland. So the oceans really are in trouble, and part of the trouble is the whole farming industry.
What are some of the other underlying causes of the decline of the world's fisheries?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there's so many things. There's global warming, for example, is a huge one. It's changing ecosystems everywhere. The reason that the Chinook salmon fishery was closed for the first time in 150 years is partly due to global warming. River water temperatures are increasing, particularly in California and Oregon. Another one people don't talk about very much is invasive species. Species like Caulerpa taxifolia, which is a kind of toxic seaweed, which took over parts of the northern Mediterranean, and it denies habitat to other kinds of fish. These things are spread, you know, the Chinese mitten crabs, these little species are spread around the world in the ballast water of cargo ships. And there's a simple way to change that is to make the cargo ships change their ballast water away from fragile estuaries and coastlines to do it while they're at sea. It's expensive, though, which is why the shipping industry tends to resist it. So, I mean, people talk about pollution, they talk about overfishing, but invasive species is actually turning out to be a huge thing. It's homogenizing the ecosystems of the world.
Could you say more about overfishing?
Yeah, for sure. Overfishing is, of course, one of the major problems. We've driven several stocks to near collapse recently. I alluded to northern cod off of the Grand Banks. That was a huge fishery, and it has disappeared. People used to think fish stocks were endless, you know. I mean, when explorers arrived in North America, they'd talk about being able to walk across salmon streams. There were so many fish, you know, or just lift the cod out from the side of a boat in baskets and buckets. And it's amazing how abundant fish used to be. We've really driven, starting with the industrialization of fishing, you know, which started in the North Sea in England around the 1850s or 60s with the first industrial trawlers. We've really driven a whole bunch of stocks to near commercial extinction. So things like bottom trawling, for example, on the high seas is a huge problem. There was supposed to be a moratorium against it. The United Nations tried to introduce it in 2006. It was voted against, and the Russian and Chinese continue to bottom trawl on fragile seamounts around the world. Often it's in pursuit of a few key species that are available in restaurants in North America and Australia. Orange roughy is one of them. It's a fish that can live to be 140 years old, doesn't reproduce until it's 40. It's very popular and good restaurants, and it's a species I think we should avoid. Other ones that are too readily available are monkfish, for example, which is often bottom trawled off our coasts. Yeah, there are a number of other species. Simply by rejigging our eating habits a little bit, we will give the oceans a bit of a break. Chilean sea bass has become notorious. There is a large stock of them off of South Georgia right now, near the Antarctic. But too often, the fish are mislabeled, poorly labeled, can't be sure where they come from. So sometimes you're better off avoiding certain long-lived species. They also tend to be the species that have the most contaminants in their flesh.
What are the problems with bottom trawling?
Bottom trawling. Bottom trawling is basically you're dragging giant nets with these huge doors that keep the nets open across the bottom of the ocean. And often you're dragging them right across these fragile seafloor structures like cold water corals. And these can take centuries, millennia to grow. And these provide habitat for other species. Once they're gone, you know. I mean, you plow the bottom floor to mud in a lot of places. Now, this has already been done off the Atlantic coast for generations, so there's not a lot of hope there. But we've got to stop doing this on the high seas and on the seamounts. There are oases which turn out to be breeding grounds for the big old females, which are the most fecund fish in the ocean, and we've got to start chasing these, or we're not going to have any fish in a generation or two. In fact, there was a study done saying that by the year 2048, at the current rate of exploitation, all the major fish stocks that we exploit will be gone unless we change our habits. And I'm confident there are ways to do that.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Tara Skrisko, author of the book Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you give us a general sense of how much seafood is eaten worldwide?
Oh, gosh. It's a huge amount. I've been to some of the big markets in the world, like Tsukiji in Tokyo, where they say one in every 10 fish in the world is consumed. That gave me a visceral sense of how much seafood is eaten, because it's a market where it's like a city within a city. There are 50,000 people who work there on any given day. There's the huge bluefin tuna auctions every morning where they auction these hundreds of fish. And while those auctions are going on at 4 in the morning, there's another one going on the market for sea urchin, another one going on for swordfish, that kind of thing. It's like a town, a giant abattoir, like the Chicago stockyards must have been. In terms of how much seafood is eaten, it's a $71 billion a year industry. And I actually know the figures. I mean, we consume about 145 million tons of seafood a year. As I say, 45% of that is farmed.
When you visited the various seafood restaurants and fish markets worldwide and doing the research for your book, what did you find most striking?
The shocking thing visiting seafood markets is the size and kinds of fish. I mean, now seafood is really globalized. You used to go to a market and you'd get what was coming from the local oceans. As fish stocks are fished out around the world, people have to go farther afield. And Another thing that's happened is that there is now international air freight. Fish, seafood is shipped in these styrofoam coffins, as they call them. And so the new Fulton Market in the South Bronx supplies New York's restaurants. It was full of things like tuna that would have been fished off of the Philippines. It's air freighted in. They did have their staple fish like whiting, which is fished off the Atlantic coast and is quite popular and in some neighborhoods fried. But what's going on, too, is the size of fish are decreasing. In Fulton, for example, they used to get these 200-pound swordfish. Now they're getting pups, you know, these little things that are only 30 or 40 pounds. And I think that's why a lot of chefs are paying attention to this, because they're actually seeing the size of the fish that are available to them decreasing. They see what's going on. So they're at the front line, and it's encouraging that a lot of chefs are getting into sustainability.
Would you like to comment on the role that chefs have played, both positive and negative, in what has happened to the world's fisheries and what is happening?
Yeah, I think that chefs have been, especially at the top restaurants in, I don't know, New York, seafood eating towns like Seattle and Boston, have been sort of apolitical about this issue for a long time. Like me, when I first started eating seafood, they thought that the seas were bottomless and fish supplies were endless. But some of them are becoming politicized, which is nice, and paying attention to the issue. Some of them, unfortunately, there's kind of a greenwash or a blue wash, I guess, in this case, where they'll talk out of both sides of their mouth. They'll talk about sustainability. I found that a lot of the chefs I interviewed in New York, for example, for the book, were doing a good job of sourcing from day boats. These are the small producers. But often, because they charge so much in these restaurants, they can actually afford to, you know, FedEx salmon in from Alaska. Now, the problem is that in the mid-level family-style restaurants, you're not going to get this. So somehow this puts a stamp of approval on a lot of species, as I mentioned, Chilean sea bass, salmon, that kind of thing, because these great restaurants, which have been sourcing them ethically, are serving them. And it's actually quite rare that this happens. You have to pay a lot of money to get the fish from the small day boats and all that, and really work on establishing your supply chains. What I find great is that a lot of chefs are now getting into the sustainability idea and really paying attention to their local purveyors, and I emphasize local.
What did you find out that suggests there may be health issues with our seafood?
Well, I mean, just being an attentive reader of the news, I mean, if you're eating seafood on a regular basis, people are saying to you, oh, are you watching out for mercury? Are you watching out for dioxins and all that? And in doing the research, I discovered that there are a lot of issues. They tend to be sort of higher up the food chain. That is, if you eat the bigger fish that eat the smaller fish, it's almost like eagles and DDT. The toxins tends to get concentrated in the fat of the bigger species. So they found that in the case of bluefin tuna, for example, you can get a really high dose of mercury from one piece of toro, the belly piece, which is so popular, of bluefin tuna. So my conclusion kind of is, and what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis, is I'm eating at the middle of the food chain things like sardines, nice fat sardines from Greece or Portugal, even Peruvian anchoveta, which you can sometimes find canned. These are like the cattle of the sea. They're herbivores. They eat lower down in the food chain. And so the toxins aren't concentrated. You can eat tons of them. They're full of omega-3s, fatty acids, which is great for brain development, you know, continued brain nutrition. Fish really is brain food, as our mothers and grandmothers told us. So, I mean, for me, yeah, pay attention to some of those smaller fish. And actually, I find that they have the most challenging and interesting flavors, whether it's Spanish mackerel done with a sherry reduction, that kind of thing. I'm discovering all kinds of, it opens up a whole part of the world. I actually find big fish like swordfish and tuna a little boring these days.
To what extent is our seafood inspected?
That's a good question. The FDA is pretty hard-pressed these days, as are a lot of federal agencies. I think the figure is, and this might have increased somewhat since I did my research, because there's been a lot of attention paid, but it was like 1.59% of the fish imported from abroad is inspected by the FDA, which is very low. And there's a lot of stuff put into the seafood. For example, the shrimp that's imported from Asia is often spiked with antibiotics. They crowd the shrimp together so tightly in the ponds that they tend to succumb to diseases. And there are permitted additives too, which I find a little weird. Sodium tripolyphosphate, which helps seafood retain moisture. And that's allowed in the United States, as is carbon monoxide, which is used to treat tuna. If you take a nice piece of bluefin and treat it with carbon monoxide, also known as tasteless smoke, it will stay pink and attractive looking for months. You can put it in a car trunk and it'll still look good. So, I mean, there's all kinds of things that you have to watch out for. But as I say, a policy of sort of eating a little lower down the food chain, you avoid a lot of these problems.
Would you speak also about the issue of seafood fraud and how often it takes place?
Yeah, it's pretty endemic. It's been going on forever. Stuff like grouper, for example, in the East, is often farmed pangasius, bassa, all kinds of other species. Grouper is getting rarer and rarer. Red snapper is rarely red snapper. Of course, in the good restaurants, you know, they have reliable suppliers in general. It's when you get to the middle range that you have to watch out. Even some chain restaurants have been caught. And often what it turns out to be is not the fancy fish that you're hoping for, the red snapper, the grouper, that kind of thing, but some kind of farmed species. What else is, God, there's so much. Yeah, I mean, the seafood fraud is, I talk about monkfish, for example. A classic one, this is really old school, is when monkfish was cheap, was to serve monkfish as lobster, which was more expensive at the time. Now monkfish has come up in price.
Let's speak now about what you discovered about fish farming and aquaculture. Would you give an overview of what you discovered about fish aquaculture and talk about both positive and negative? Maybe talk about salmon farming in BC, but also oyster farming.
Yeah, no, I mean, some people just say, oh, I won't touch farmed seafood. You know, I prefer wild. I think people are deluding themselves when they say that, because if you like seafood at all, about half of the seafood now is farmed. So it's hard to stay away from it. And there's great forms of aquaculture. The problem with farm salmon right now, and it's a huge industry, and salmon is one of the top five seafoods in the United States. I think it's second only to shrimp right now, is that it's raised in net pens in the ocean, so off the coast of British Columbia and Chile right now. And the industry is controlled by three Norwegian companies. They definitely crowd the pens with fish. There can be a million Atlantic salmon living in the Pacific Ocean in these net pens that are like the size of a tennis court, basically. And lately, they've been attracting natural parasites called sea lice, which are thumbtack-sized parasites which are spread to the wild salmon. And in British Columbia, this is causing might cause the collapse of pink salmon population in certain areas, and it's even spreading to other species like herring. So it's a huge problem. Chile right now, farmed salmon, once again, because of overcrowding, have come down with something called ISA. It's a disease, a wasting disease. So Safeway stopped carrying Chilean salmon. On the positive side, salmon aquaculture can be done in closed containment tanks, in concrete tanks. There's one company in British Columbia that's doing that now, and they're raising coho salmon, and there's no contact with the ocean waters. Actually, this is raised inland, and they're selling them to restaurants in Vancouver. It's a great system, and hopefully that kind of thing will take off. I mean, other species are already raised this way. There's striped bass, I believe Arctic char, that kind of thing. So with a little more investment, we can avoid all these problems.
Could you say just a couple of words about oyster farming?
Sure. Oyster farming has been going on for millennia, actually. It goes on back to the times of the Romans, when this fellow in the Bay of Naples put broken crockery into the bottom and allowed the oyster spats to grow on the broken crockery. So he was raising them way back then. I went to France for the book, Brittany, where they've been raising these fabulous Boulogne oysters since the 19th century. There used to be a wild oyster catch off in the Chesapeake Bay, and they still use these skipjacks, these sailing boats, to harvest them. But it was pretty easy to exhaust the wild beds. I find oyster and mussel aquaculture great because it does clean out the oceans. I know it's controversial in Washington State. There have been some problems, I think, in Willapa Bay. But in the long run, it's better to encourage this kind of thing because oysters and mussels remove plankton from the oceans, therefore preventing blooms, which can lead to these giant dead zones. There's a huge dead zone off the coast of Oregon right now, and that's likely caused by, you know, overproduction of plankton in the oceans. So every time you eat an oyster, you're helping the oceans.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Tara Skresko, author of the book Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. What principles do you use when buying fish or selecting items from a seafood menu? You've been alluding to this, but maybe you could just give a summary of what you take into consideration.
When I'm at a restaurant, I want to eat locally, I mean, whenever it's possible. I go out of my way to find a good restaurant often, and I like to get things from the region. So I look for things that might come from the local area. I also tend to avoid things that have been shipped from a long distance. They've probably been frozen, and, you know, that's not what I'm paying for. I've started to ask questions in restaurants, and I think that's really key. You have to ask whether things are farmed or wild. You have to know that fish come from a certain place on the planet. people talk about terroir, you know, in relation to wines and things like that. We should start thinking of miroir. Where in the oceans did these things come from? First of all, is it the Pacific or the Atlantic? You know, could be Pacific halibut, could be Atlantic halibut. You should know this because Atlantic halibut are practically endangered, but Pacific halibut are in pretty good shape. So the principles that I've picked up are really, one of the principles is the principle of curiosity. Start asking questions and don't be afraid to ask your waiter or your fishmonger where things come from. And we have to be demanding better labeling. There's already country of origin labeling laws in the United States, but often it just refers to the country where the stuff is processed. If it was filleted in China, it'll say product of China. We should be able to know where the fish comes from, which ocean, for example. If it's cod, we should say came from the Atlantic.
And could you underscore again the species that are better choices?
Well, I'd say that for me, the big species are that I've been eating on a regular basis after doing all the research are the little guys like sardines, herring, mackerel. Tilapia is a pretty good farmed fish, not too exciting. Some people will say carp, it's another herbivorous fish. If you want a big protein hit, there's Arctic char, barramundi. Mahi-mahi is a fish that's, the fish stocks are in pretty good shape right now. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of species out there. And off the West Coast, I've been eating black cod or sable fish, which is this really buttery fleshed fish and a nice alternative to Chilean sea bass.
Are there species that you would recommend that people should just simply avoid?
Well, as I mentioned, there's orange roughy. Definitely stay away from that. Bluefin tuna is in incredibly rough shape right now. We might be fishing out the last of them in the Mediterranean. Monkfish, because of the way it's fished and the fact that stocks are at an all-time low, is probably one to avoid, too. And there are tools available for people. There's the Monterey Bay Aquarium's Seafood Watch card, wallet card, but also website. And they've got sort of red-listed species. So this is a handy thing to carry around right now. And that's seafoodwatch.org.
What do you see as the obstacles to making more sustainable seafood available?
Well, you know, meat. Poultry is relatively simple. It's, you know, one couple of species. The big obstacle is sort of education and knowledge about these things. There's 350 kinds of seafood, I think, available in the markets in the United States, in supermarkets, restaurants. So I think that as people start to realize that, you know, seafood is one of the best sources of protein still out there, one of the healthiest, they will start educating themselves about these issues. And as I say, labeling. I mean, it would be relatively simple to change labeling laws and demand better eco-labeling. For example, the Marine Stewardship Council has a blue and white eco-label. I'd love to see that in a lot more supermarkets. They certify sustainable fisheries around the world right now.
So do you think that certification systems are a useful approach?
I think they're useful. I don't think they're always... There have been a lot of questions about the MSC, for example, their certification of the pollock fishery off of Alaska, one of the world's biggest fisheries, and their certification of the hoki fishery. Pollock, for example, a lot of salmon are taken, a lot of other species are taken, and some people believe that pollock are being removed from the mouths of marine mammals as well. But the MSC does a lot of great certifications as well, and the problem is it's better than nothing. What we need is a good certification scheme for farm seafood. And I know the WWF, the World Wildlife Fund, is currently trying to develop one, and they might implement one with channel catfish, southern catfish, fairly soon.
Which countries are most and least responsible in efforts to protect the world's fisheries?
The most responsible, Australia has been doing quite a good job. All of the countries, including the United States, that were in favor of the moratorium on bottom trawling, I applaud for sure. Unfortunately, there's countries that don't seem to care right now. Russia, China, Taiwan, their trawlers are present off the shores of Africa, for example. The EU has been awful about subsidizing super trawlers, which are removing sardines and other forage fish from the coast of Africa. Spain is responsible for too much shark finning. The fins are taken off sharks to supply the shark fin soup market in Asia. And there's just a lot of pirate vessels out there and a lack of enforcement, which is awful because those guys are, the pirate vessels are chasing down the last of the big fish. And gourmets and gourmands are paying huge prices for these in Europe, Asia, and in some parts of North America.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, keep on eating seafood, but be as selective as possible and favor policies that foster the oceans. Vote for officials that are in favor of this too. One of the most hopeful things we can do is create marine reserves, marine protected areas, or no-take zones, they're also called, where fishing is limited. And they found in places like New Zealand, this has led to a spectacular rebirth of the oceans. Off the coast of Florida, Cape Canaveral, where no fishing is allowed, there are huge fish there, you know, giant swordfish and marlins. And that's because fishing has been restricted. And fishermen end up getting behind this, even though it might not be popular to begin with, because these areas turn out to be nursery areas for adjoining areas. So if we give the oceans a bit of a break, there is hope for recovery.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Terrace.
A real pleasure, Nate.
We have just been speaking with Terrace Gresko, author of the book Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood, published in 2008 by Bloomsbury Press. For more information, check on the web at www.terracegresko.com. Again, that's TarasGresco.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.